question of meaning and the search for meaning, really, it's a worldwide struggle. It has been a worldwide phenomenon. I remember being asked to do a lecture on this at Johns Hopkins, along with Francis Collins, the co-mapper of the human DNA, in the great project genome project that he did, along with another scientist. And as we were there, and many other of other worldviews were speaking, I kept looking at the subject: what does it mean to be human? And I thought to myself, isn't it funny that we're here in the 21st century and we don't know what it means to be human? If we don't know what it means to be human, what does humanism really mean? It's just an ism to a term we don't understand. But big words are used all along. And you think to yourself, you say, you know, dogs really don't get together for a conference to discuss the meaning of dogginess. It's not an issue to them. By instinct, they just live out dogginess. We're the ones who are the smartest ones on the planet, and we don't know who we really are. But the terms are getting bigger and bigger. Coming from the East, we wrestle with these issues. We've wrestled with these issues historically, philosophically. I don't know any Eastern philosopher who hasn't struggled with this. And I remember growing up in Delhi, where India was my homeland. I lived in India till I was 20, growing up in Delhi, so very comfortable, very fluent in Hindi. My mother was from Chennai in the south, so I'm quite comfortable with the southern Indian language of Tamil as well. And listening to those songs, it's the poets that really ask the haunting questions. In northern India, in Delhi, there was a song that went like this. The Hindi may not mean anything to you, but I will translate it. In one of India's most famous movies, probably its all-time greatest movie, which is called Mother India, went like this: Duniya mein hum aaye hain to jeena hi padega, jeevan hai agar zeher to peena hi padega. If I have come into this world, I have to live. If living means a gradual consumption of poison, I have to drink it. It's the way it's said. Na main Bhagwan hu, na main Shaitan hu. I'm not God, I'm not Satan. Jinya jo, dunya jo chaho samjhe, O world, think whatever you will. Main to insaan hu. I'm merely a human being. I'm not God, I'm not Satan, I'm only a human being. Coming into this world, I don't know what it means, but if it means a gradual drinking of poison, I will drink it. And so the philosophers wax eloquent and the poets wax eloquent, and they ask the question of meaning. Malcolm Muggeridge, writing in the 1970s, the great British journalist, said, "It is difficult to resist the conclusion that 20th century man has decided to abolish himself. Tired of the struggle to be himself, he has created boredom out of his own affluence, impotence out of his own erotomania, and vulnerability out of his own strength. He himself blows the trumpet that brings the walls of his own cities crashing down, until at last, having educated himself into imbecility, having drugged and polluted himself into stupefaction, he keels over a weary, battered old brontosaurus and becomes extinct." Educated himself into imbecility, become so educated and so idiotic at the same time. Aldous Huxley, writing in the 1940s, as a skeptic, said, "We are living today not in the delicious intoxication of the early successes of science, rather in the grisly morning after, where it has become quite apparent that what science may have actually done is to introduce us to improved means in order to obtain hitherto unimproved or rather deteriorated ends." What science may have done is increased our methods for ultimately contemptible goals. So if thinkers and philosophers raise this issue of human destiny while at the same time not really knowing what is the meaning of human essence, it's a quandary of unimaginable proportions. How do we deal with it? How do we respond to it? You know, we can respond to it from theological terms, and the world's religions will pitch in. Hinduism may make you equal with the divine in its pantheistic worldview. Islam may make you so distant from the divine that you wonder if there's ever a bridge between the totally transcendent God and a minute, finite human being. Christianity may confer upon you the imago Dei, the image of God, which tells you that you have that propensity for moral movement and direction, but you still cannot lift yourself up by your own moral bootstraps. All these definitions may come, and when you and I are alone in our rooms, we ask ourselves the question, what does life really mean? I heard today while we were driving in here that over 100 people chose to take their lives by jumping in front of a train in Belgium last year. Japan records a very high number of suicides. As a matter of fact, my own journey to Christ began on a bed of suicide when I was 17 years old. Why? Because I could not find any meaning in life or any explanation. You see, when you go through the history of thought, you go into maybe from the 11th to the 14th centuries, you're dealing with the philosophy that moved towards rationalism with a capital R. Man was going to become the measure of all things by human reason alone, that mathematics was the only indubitably certain discipline. But you moved beyond that, and you realize that as the Renaissance and the Enlightenment came, man was going to become the measure of all things. But nobody said which man was going to strive to get there. Then you arrived in the 18th century, and people like David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, and others were looking for certainty and said it was only ultimately in the empirical worldview, by the ways of scientific measurement, that we would find out what was true. So from rationalism with a capital R, we went to the empiricist who was going to define life. After the empiricist had done his work in the 1900s, nihilism came to be, the philosophy of unyielding despair. And on the heels of that came existentialism, will to power, will to passion, will to meaning, that in the face of despair, you choose to arrogate to yourself whatever meaning you want to follow, a la Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus and the rest of them who became very popular existentialist writers. So from rationalism to empiricism to existentialism. And now where are you and I? In the world of postmodernism, which debunks all of these and arrives at categories of no truth, no meaning, no certainty. Language itself is questioned, whether the author reserves the right to fuse the word with a rightful meaning, or the reader reserves the right to interpret the author in any way he or she chooses. So meaning is tossed up into the winds, and you grab the grains that you really want. Moving from the mathematical, indubitable uncertainty through the laboratory to man becoming the measure of all things, and will to passion and power, ultimately, that none of these have absolute points of reference. You have to find it in your own way and in your own time, and that's where the postmodern worldview is. But nobody really wants a postmodernist for a pilot. Yeah, I know my instruments say 10,000 feet, but why believe the instruments? I have a feeling it's not 10,000 feet. There are absolutes. There are unshakable absolutes. So what I want to do, ladies and gentlemen, in the time that we have this morning, or this evening, it's morning for me. I've just flown in from Thailand last night, and it's a 12-hour difference. I looked at it here, and it's actually 2 a.m. for me. So I might sound like that as well. But you move into these categories, and you ask yourself the question, what is meaning? How do I find it? Some years ago in Western Canada, in the city of, I won't name the city, it was in Midwestern Canada. There was a packed audience, and a woman from my part of the world was sitting in the front row every night. And she would take notes, copious notes, as I would speak. And I wondered what she was really writing. Very heavily into her notes. And on the last night, she came up to me and she said, "Can I talk to you?" I said, "Yes." So we sat down in the front row and she talked. She said, "My husband was a very prominent medical doctor in this city." She said, "I can take you to one street where there are three or four apartment buildings owned by us. Very well to do." She said, "Every night he would wake up in the middle of the night, go out and do some rounds. He was a very conscientious doctor. For all the surgeries performed, he would go and check into his patients, come back again about 3 or 4 in the morning, get a little sleep, go back to work the next day and do his surgeries." She said, "So on this one night, he got up and left, and I didn't think anything of it." She said, "I was aware that he had come back because I could sense the kitchen light was on, but it was a usual routine for him, so I didn't do anything. I just went back to sleep." She said, "All of a sudden, I was awakened with a tremendous thud, a bang, a loud noise. I shook up in bed. I called for my husband. He didn't answer. I got up of bed, walked over to the kitchen, and there he was with his head down on the kitchen table, and I knew something was wrong. I walked over towards him, and he was gone. And in front of him, a notepaper with a pen beside it. Some people die natural deaths. Other people, unable to face life anymore, choose to take it. That is my choice. I wish you all goodbye as my family, and I'm sorry I'm leaving you like this." And this Indian woman, crying in the front row of an auditorium, angry at all of this, him leaving her with all the young children to take care of, and all of the affairs that had to be settled. She said, "I want to ask you why. Why does anybody do this?" I looked at her and I said, "I cannot answer that question for you. I didn't even know your husband. It's the first time I'm talking to you. But I will tell you one thing. For many human beings, despair is not a moment, it's a way of life. Despair is not just a moment, it is a way of life." It's true. And it's not true necessarily of the world of poverty. It is often more true of the world of wealth. When you have got everything you ever dreamed about, it was Jack Higgins, the award-winning novelist, who was interviewed after his award-winning book, The Eagle Has Landed, was asked the question, "What do you now know that you'd wished you'd known as a younger man?" He said, "I wished I'd known then what I know now, that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. I wished I'd known then what I know now, that when you get to the top, there's nothing there." Can I try and give to you, in the simplest terms I can, what are the rudimentary components that bring meaning to life? And it'll start off from the picture and the eyes of a child and ultimately move into the world of an adult. So please bear with me. But these, I believe, are the components needed. So when I talk about meaning in life, I believe these four have a confluence of coming together into a composite, into a whole. They cannot stand in isolation. So if you take any one of these in isolation, it'll implode under its own weight. But you bring them together with the other components and you will see exactly what I mean. So bear with me till I unfold my argument. I wrote a book called Recapture the Wonder. And that is really the outline of what I want to bring to you. How does one find meaning in life? What are the hints we find at the stages of life, if you will, in which these components ultimately must come together? The first is the component of what I call the sense of wonder or enchantment. The sense of wonder or enchantment. We all know that in the eyes of a baby. We all see that in the eyes of an infant. whether it's a Christmas tree that the eyes get wide at, or whether it's hearing some sound that is enchanting for the first time. G.K. Chesterton, the moralist philosopher, said, "I learned more from observing a nursery than I ever did in my lectures in philosophy." I have only in the last 7 months become a grandfather. I know I don't look it like it, but it is quite a daunting thought to suddenly realize you are married to a grandmother. That's the way life is. And she would have her own say on that, I have no doubt. But you know, when you're young and you have your kids the first time around, life is hectic, you're earning a living, you're doing all of this, and you don't really take time to watch all the thrills as much as you need to. Now at this stage in life, when you hold a tiny little one, that's your grandchild, in your arms, and you begin to see the thrill of a little one with each new experience, you realize how marvelous and how beautiful life is all about, really. I'd been traveling for 7 weeks with my traveling associate, Kryn, and we'd been gone to many countries, and I'd been praying each day that whenever this little grandchild was born, that I would be there. And I was on pins and needles for those 7 weeks that he would come a little too early, and I'd be miles away, and my daughter would never forgive me. We arrived on a certain day at 3 p.m., and I was in the train in the Atlanta train airport going to the baggage claim, and I turned to Kryn and I said, "I wonder if it'll happen today now that I'm home." We got home at 5:15 p.m. At 6:15, our phone rang, my son-in-law saying, "We're on our way to the hospital, the baby's coming any minute." And within an hour, we were there, and I held my little grandson in my arms. I have been known to induce labor in a lot of people, but it was nice to have done that in my own daughter's case. I held that little one in my arms, all of 5 pounds and 10 ounces. It's a magnificent sense to hold that child. 2 days later, I was in a bank talking to one of our bank tellers. They asked me, "How's Naomi doing?" I said, "You know, they know my daughter Naomi." I said, "The baby's here, newly born baby." And I looked at the teller and I said, "You know what? When I look at a baby like that, I say to myself, how does anyone not believe in God?" And you know what she said? "And how does anyone ever think of hurting a little one like that?" The two realities of life immediately converged in discussing a newborn baby, the wonder of life and the hideousness of human depravity. That you can see something so magnificent and yet recognize that there are capacities. In fact, the first thing the nurse said to her when she came into the room while my wife and I were there are to give her the security protection for the baby and the wristband so that if that child were ever taken into an elevator on that floor anywhere, it would trigger an alarm system. And imagine a young mother who's just held her little baby in her arms being told of the possibility of a child being kidnapped. Shocking, absolutely shocking. Now you watch that little child grow and the enchantment and wonder. And then you find out how marvelous the fairy tales really are. And you start reading the fairy tales as they get older. And you noticed two things about every fairy tales. There is the extraordinary thing that you notice, the wonder world of enchantment. But then two things come into that fairy tale very quickly. If you don't come back by such and such, you will become a such and such. It's always a condition. If you don't come back by 12 o'clock, you'll become a pumpkin. That sort of stuff. And no one ever says to the fairy godmother, "How come?" G.K. Chesterton says, because if you say to the fairy godmother, "How come?" you may as well be prepared for the fairy godmother to say to you, "How come there is even a fairyland?" There's always a condition, and there's always the recognition of the mystery that you don't always question every condition. The conditions are there for life. Now, what I want to say to you is this. If you take wonder away, and you take enchantment away, you take the mystique and the mystery away of a little life, and as life goes on, two things will happen. You know, number what the first thing will happen? The first thing that will happen is you will lose a sense of gratitude and think you owe nothing to anybody. You are really the provider of all of your needs. The loss of gratitude always follows the loss of a sense of wonder. I lived and grew up in Delhi. I never earned a penny in my pocket until I left India at 20 years old. I never even received any pocket money. I just knew how to make friends with kids who got pocket money. And I knew how to enjoy all those things with people who had it. I never had it. And I always dreamed of the great day that you could go somewhere to the West and start earning money and making it big time. And in a strange way, that dream came. I went when I was 20 and moved to Toronto, Canada, and lived in Toronto, studied there, went into business and was preparing all of that. And I noticed some of the loneliest people in the world. I was in the hotel business. Some of the loneliest people in the world would be sitting there at night with something in their hand to drown their sorrows and drown their monotony and drown their boredom. And I found myself trying to answer questions of people who had 10 times more than I did. Now in America, we're in a quandary financially. We borrowed and borrowed and borrowed against that which we could not repay. In English, you have a saying of certainty. You can take that to the bank, but you better not say that now. Have you insured that? You're not sure about the insurance companies now. You're not sure about the banks now. And for the first time in about 40 years of living in the West, I drive past shopping centers and malls where you see tiny businesses shut down. And it has all come on the heels of the last 20 or 25 years of irresponsible living that has come hand in hand with the rejection of the place of God in human destiny. We don't want to, you can go to the Forbidden City in Beijing today on a given day in December and see Merry Christmas. And yet in the United States, you take your life in your hands in a public institution if you put up a sign called Merry Christmas. Somebody from the American Civil Liberties Union will want to sue you for that. They want to ban prayer in schools. I saw a bumper sticker that said, as long as there are mathematics examinations, there will always be prayer in schools. It's true, because you may know that 2 + 2 = 4, but the next question is going to stump you. God, please help me. But that's what's happened to us in the West. We've lost our belief in the transcendent power because we've lost our sense of gratitude. They don't want to call it Christmas anymore or Thanksgiving anymore. They call it Turkey Day, which may say more about the people than it does about the turkey. Amazing, amazing. You know what? When you don't pause long enough to thank God even for your health and your strength, you are actually saying you are totally self-contained in all that you need. A man looked at Winston Churchill one day and said, I'm a self-made man. Churchill looked at him and said, you have just relieved God of a very solemn responsibility. You lose your sense of wonder, you lose your sense of gratitude. You know, some years ago, there was an Air Canada flight coming in from somewhere, I think in Connecticut or Cincinnati or something like that. It was flying into Toronto, and there was a fire that started in the washroom of the plane, and the fire started to spread. I remember being there at that time and reading about it. And this plane literally had to plummet in height. and it landed in Toronto and hit the ground so hard in the runway, the wheels broke on landing, and when the doors opened, it was turned into an inferno. And what happened was the fire engines and all ready, people were rescued. The last man to leave the cabin was the pilot himself, while his uniform had begun to catch fire and the flames were doused. He refused to give any interviews on it because it was such a sobering, scary moment. But he rescued with his staff all of the passengers on board. What happened the next day was one passenger after another saying, "We thank that pilot for his skill and his courage. He brought us down safely, and he was the last man to leave after every passenger had disembarked and been rescued." If you were on that plane, you'd want to thank that captain too. It was just a few days later, an American airliner was coming back from the Bahamas somewhere, and it lost power in one engine, two, three, and finally the fourth, and the pilot's voice was heard saying, "Ditching is inevitable." Until all of its own, one engine started, and he limped back to safety. Who do you thank then? My honor to be with you here at Princeton.
When I was in Germany.
India, very close to Bangladesh.
George Washington University.
The Middle East.
Meetings in Angola prison.
United States.
From China.
In Canada.
In the United Kingdom.
In Istanbul, in Ankara, and Izmir.
Romania.
At American University.
In the University of Harvard.
In Manila, in the Philippines.
Perth, Australia.
To South Africa.
In Africa.
So the global family of humanity is really like what John Wesley would have said, the world is our parish.
You've been watching Let My People Think with Dr. Ravi Zacharias. We're grateful for your prayers and financial support. If you'd like to know more about this ministry or would like to donate to our efforts, you can call us at 1-800-448-6766 or visit us online at rzim.org. You can also stay connected to RZIM through one of our social media accounts. Our mailing address is RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. Next time on Let My People Think.
You take away wonder, you will lose gratitude. You take away wonder, you will lose a sense of limitation. And you take away wonder, you will ultimately lose a sense of fulfillment. Wonder is indispensable, and I'll tell you why this is so critical to understand. The older you get, the more it takes to fill your heart with wonder, and only God is big enough to fill that.
Let My People Think is a listener-supported television ministry and is furnished by Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Atlanta, Georgia.